Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by SeeRadioDifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Robin Hicks.
This week,
Hungry Jack's tries to go healthy with a cup full of veggies.
Rivers promotes ugly clogs in new ad.
There's ugly, there's really ugly, then there's Rivers Summer Clogs.
Tourism Victoria's move from Mojo.
Branding, luxurious Australia.
Merrick moves to Triple M.
I'm not going to Triple M with the intent of kicking back and sitting on the beanbag. You know, I'm going there to get tools out and work hard.
In television, Charlie's Angels, stalled takeoff, and not so much Joy of Sense. With us today in the studios of CBS Interactive is Mumbrella publisher Martin Lane.
Hello, Tim.
Outgoing podcast producer Alice Terlikowski.
Hi, Tim.
And incoming podcast producer Colin Delaney.
Hello, Tim.
Kicking off, fast food chain Hungry Jack's has announced this week that it will offer cups of vegetables as part of a trial in New South Wales stores. The salad sticks spelt S-T-I-X, include capsicum, which I prefer to think of as peppers, celery, broccoli and carrot, and they'll be served with an optional hummus dip. Aaron McKee, or possibly Mackay, CEO of the chain, describes the dish as a nutritional goldmine. Robin, what do you think's behind this?
Well, first of all, I think it's a PR stunt, but I think that it's perhaps one that's gone a little awry of the Hungry Jack's brand. To me, it's Hungry Jack's is all about better burgers, and ashamedly so. Why they're going down the healthy route so long after the likes of McDonald's have introduced it, I'm not quite sure. I like the positioning. The burgers are better at Hungry Jack's. I think that really works. Their advertising is unusual, interesting. Certainly, I'm not sure whether they'd even think about introducing this to their advertising, which is a key question. But, for me, not a great move.
Martin, are you persuaded?
Well, when I first saw it, I actually thought it was a joke. If I go to Hungry Jack's, I'm either hungover or I've got my kids with me. I'm going because I want to eat a load of saturated fats. I'm not going because I just simply have to have a serving of fresh vegetables.
Well, you wouldn't like your children to have vegetables.
Occasionally they're allowed a treat. But, you know, I don't really understand. It's not going to play to Hungry Jack's traditional customers because they just want to, you know, eat burgers and chips. And it's not really going to please the tree huggers as far as I can see because it just smacks of tokenism. You know, we murder millions of cows every year, but it's okay because we serve them with a side of broccoli.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I just wonder, Robin, whether maybe partly it's about seizing back the agenda for McDonald's, particularly as McDonald's are sort of celebrating their 40th birthday at the moment. Only a week or two since they were talking about kids' meals.
Yeah, no, indeed, we've seen that, not only kids' meals, but KFC have just removed their toys from their meals. So it seems to be a lot of sort of PR initiatives on the behalf of fast food chains at the moment.
Alice?
Well, it is interesting about the timing with McDonald's because they lost their the right to use the Heart Foundation tick very recently. I think it was only last week. They pay an amount of money a year so that it can put the tick next to some of their more healthy options.
Yes, I think all you needed to get the tick was be best in category, which
right.
In some of them, you know, it's kind of like, you know, doing well in a school sports day or something. It doesn't necessarily mean you're a great athlete.
Sure, and the Heart Foundation had said that they were taking the tick off crust pizzas as well. It wasn't necessarily a reflection on McDonald's, but it was the way they were going. But I find it interesting timing that McDonald's loses their tick, and now I wonder if Hungry Jack's sped up, you know, this promotion of their new vegetable offering to, you know, to get one up on McDonald's.
Isn't it just a fairly straightforward strategy to get people that wouldn't otherwise eat Hungry Jack's into the stores? You go into a store for a salad, but, you know, you end up buying a burger as well.
I wonder whether it's just the shield, though. Maybe it's not even about whether people buy them. It's just when people criticise them, they have the defence, we have healthy choices too.
But would you go into Hungry Jack's for a cup of vegetables? Like, a salad, people like to eat salads, but this is a cup of vegetables with a dip, you know, I'm not sure how big the dip is, but I've seen the picture. It doesn't look that appealing.
Colin, wearing your consumer hat, are you persuaded?
Not entirely, no. I'd like to see Hungry Jack's, after a few months, revoke their cup and just say, we're fast food. Why try and be anything else, unlike McDonald's, who have tried to do this? And does anyone go in there for their healthy options? Probably not.
I mean, that's a good point. That is, I think it's just being rolled out in a few stores in New South Wales to start with. Yeah. I mean, I'd be amazed if it's actually rolled out around the country. I don't think it will be.
Next, Ugly Clogs.
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone All-Time Prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
Budget clothing brand Rivers has released an ad for their $4.90 rubber clogs, which are basically their version of popular footwear Crocs.
Hey, take a look at these bad boys. There's ugly, there's really ugly, then there's Rivers Summer Clogs. Look, they might be majorly comfy, but they are butt ugly. I mean, even for $4.90 a pair, I wouldn't be seen dead in them. But now the entire family can be ugly together. Men's ugly, women's ugly, kids ugly. And you can do this ugly thing in a huge range of colours. $4.90, 4 days only.
TV viewers will be familiar with Rivers' advertising technique. Pretty basic and produced on what we would assume a fairly small budget, and almost certainly, I would imagine, without a creative agency. So, Colin, you drew our attention to this ad, which I really like. Were you a fan?
I am, yes. As a fat idiot, I'm a fan of self-deprecation, so I really like the fact that they poke fun at themselves.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, thank you, yes. But look, any company that's willing to poke fun at themselves, I tend to appreciate more. Will I go and buy those clogs? Probably not. Mm. Will I think more of Rivers? Yes.
Yeah.
Kind of reminds me of the Volkswagen Lemon ads from back in the 60s, which our listeners may remember as being in the first episode of Mad Men. It is subverting and poking fun at themselves again.
So Tim, what do you think of this sort of reverse advertising tactic? I think subvertising it's called.
Yeah, I mean, partly I wonder whether we're making too much fuss about this particular one, because Rivers have been doing it for yonks. This is just a particularly amusing one, I guess. But yeah, it's about cut through, isn't it? The one ad that always cuts through in that break, because it's stylistically so different, is the stuff for Rivers. You know, it tends to be sort of relatively cheap airtime during the day or whatever. And it's, you know, sort of quite reassuring. If you're in other parts of the country, then you'll often see it as well. But obviously with what the, you know, what the local offer is. But arguably it's no different than, you know, Combank trying to stand out by being black and white in their ads or whatever it is. You know, it's a different way of kind of cutting through.
Mm. Yeah, I think also what's interesting, it's quite a bland brand of clothing, right, that just so happens to have quite interesting risque advertising. It's also Rivers, it should be noted, that was wrapped by the Advertising Standards Bureau recently for sexualising, I think it's sexualising violence, with a picture of a dead woman in fishnet stockings trapped under a sofa. So it's obviously trying to push the boat out quite a bit in terms of its advertising, but I'm not sure that it works. Martin, going back to the original thing about the ugly ad, does it make you want to buy them?
Yeah, well, you already wear them though, don't you, Martin?
I have absolutely no idea whether it's genius or terrible. And looking at the Mumbrella comment stream, neither do Mumbrella readers, because it seems to be pretty much split 50-50 for and against. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, you remember it. It certainly cuts through, as Tim said. I'm still struggling with the word subvertising. I can't really get beyond that at the moment, I'm afraid. Did you make that up?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. OK. No.
Next, Mojo loses Tourism Victoria.
Thinking of working at an ad agency? Looking for the best creatives to develop your next ad campaign? Look no further than the Mumbrella Creative Agency Review. 148 pages of hardcore industry intelligence to help you make your next big agency decision. Visit book.focalattractions.com.au/MCAR.
You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. For more on all these stories, visit mumbrella.com.au. After 18 years, Tourism Victoria has parted ways with creative agency Mojo. It wasn't completely unexpected. It's instead moved its business to Clevenger BBDO Melbourne after it won the pitch, which was called at the beginning of March. Now, Mojo's legacy includes the extremely successful You'll Love Every Piece of Victoria campaign, which included the map of Victoria drawn as a jigsaw, and other people, including Sean Cummins, have had parts of that campaign as well. Marty, you come from something of a, certainly as a journalist, having shown an interest in written about tourism in the past. Some pretty good campaigns for Tourism Victoria in the past. What would you say they've done well and what haven't they done well?
Well, I think the interesting thing about this is that the genesis of the campaign, the You'll Love Every Piece of Victoria campaign, was that the thinking being that Victoria and specifically Melbourne didn't have a real kind of tourism icon. You know, you could argue the Great Ocean Road or maybe the MCG, but it's not got the Opera House, it's not got the Harbour Bridge. And so the idea was that the pieces make up more than the whole. So that was the kind of strategy behind it, and it's served the test of time because it's been around for a long while. I thought what was interesting was that the chair of Tourism Victoria said that campaign has done great things and positioned Melbourne to the point where it's the most popular tourist city in Australia, which suggests to me that possibly it might have done its job and now there'll be a bigger focus on Melbourne. And we've seen that already with the Pure Melbourne campaign. I think that it might be that it's kind of run its course. It's done a good job, but it's time for something else.
Alice, going forward?
I kind of liken the jigsaw You Love Every Piece of Victoria campaign with Tourism New Zealand's 100% New Zealand. Pure New Zealand. I have to disagree with Martin there in the fact that I think it should hang around simply because it has been successful. That jigsaw map of Victoria is recognisable, and I think like I said with Tourism New Zealand, it's that kind of campaign has really resonated and worked really well within the industry and broader to the consumer market. So I hope that with Clem's taking over that they, recognise that has been successful, add a new touch, but I hope it stays.
Robin, you recently looked at both Publicis Mojo in Melbourne and Clem's in Melbourne as well as part of the Umbrella Creative Agency review. What do you think losing this account means to Mojo?
I think it means an awful lot. I was down in Melbourne relatively recently. I was asking the people at Mojo Melbourne what this could mean, losing it. Do you have a plan B? They said absolutely not. We're 100% focused on winning this account. We cannot possibly conceive of losing this account. It would be disastrous. The question has been raised as to whether Publicis Mojo Melbourne can actually keep going as an agency without its linchpin and most important client. It still, mind you, it still has business. It still has Toyota, Cadbury's, Garnier, Nestle left. They're decent clients, but what they really do need is a dramatic overhaul, much like McCann is receiving at the moment. Sort of rip it out and start again sort of strategy. They've got some good people. The creative director, Michelle Walsh, is very capable. She's been there 9 years, very passionate about Mojo. But yes, I do think it's a case of hitting the reset button and starting again.
Now, while we're on the subject of tourism, Alice, you just in the last few days have been talking to Tourism Australia's Nick Baker, who's marketing director, and also to DDB's Dylan Harrison, who's ECD in Sydney, about plans for the next Tourism Oz campaign.
Yes, it was at the launch of their domestic campaign, which was an extension of their There's Nothing Like Australia brand positioning, and their next campaign, which is penned for release. This hasn't been confirmed yet, but they were talking second quarter of next year. Will also be an extension of There's Nothing Like Australia, so that's going to hang around. But they've said that they want to really amplify the luxury accommodation options in Australia, which is something they say international visitors aren't aware of, the luxury element. Obviously, with a lot of stakeholders in the Australian tourism business from all kind of levels of tourism, be it backpacker, student travel, high-end luxury travel. There's going to be a lot of people interested to see how they're going to really leverage luxury tourism without excluding other markets. They have said they, want to also harness luxury experiences. It's not all about the dollar value. It's about the the white beaches and the luxurious holidays you can have. But it's going to be interesting to see what kind of response they get from the market.
Martin, good segment.
I have a bit of a problem with this because I think it's really a case of kind of making a virtue out of necessity. The fact is that the Australian dollar is making Australia incredibly expensive as a tourist destination. It's killing the budget sector. It's really hurting the mid-market sector. So the thinking is, I assume, let's go after the people with more money than sense, which might be a good strategy. The problem is that I don't think Australia's actually got the product to match. And I don't think it can compete with places like the Maldives or you know, a luxury safari in Kenya. And I think that's going to be the problem. It's marketing to the fact that it's very expensive rather than it genuinely can deliver luxury, in my opinion.
Now, Robin, you've written about the Asian market. Do you think the Asian consumers are out there for this sort of luxury, high-end advertising?
Obviously, Asia's a big place and the market's usually fragmented. I'd say that, you know, emerging middle classes there are in China and India, absolutely.
And what do they think of Australia and Australians?
I think the perception is, and I used to live in Singapore and also Hong Kong, I think the perception there, to be frankly quite negative, is that Australia is perhaps a little bit technologically backward, certainly compared to Hong Kong and Singapore, which has very, very high-tech transport systems, etc., whereas Australia's slightly behind in that regard. And perhaps a little bit of an uncultured hinterland. I've had that heard that very phrase used in Asia. So, yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, I guess sort of Australia obviously has a raw, rugged beauty, but perhaps culturally less.
The outback's full of bogans, that's what it means.
Possibly, yeah. Yeah. that's possible.
Hinterland is a kind word for redneck.
Yeah, sort of redneck backwards. Is actually, yeah, the word I was probably looking for. But, yeah, I'd say the brand perception is a raw, sort of rugged, beautiful country, but perhaps lacking in a touch of class.
Alice, you're dying to come to Australia's defence.
Look, no, I'm not, but I think it's important that I say something that Dylan had said to me. It was the fact that they were targeting this emerging middle class affluent Asian tourists, and they've been very vocal about the fact that they are now targeting China is a massive market for them at the moment. So that will, if that's the perception of you know, Asian travellers coming to Australia, then there's going to be a big hurdle to overcome regardless of how many luxurious places we have. Australia's a big place, and that whole perception is going to have to be changed for that to work.
Now, speaking of branding, Australia has ranked third in the world as the country with the strongest reputation. And obviously, different surveys have different methodologies for this. In this particular survey, Australia ranked behind Sweden and Canada. But for brands and innovation, it ranked 15th in the world. The top-ranking innovative countries were Japan, Germany and the US. This research was carried out by STW Group's AMR. And the sample or the base was about 42,000 people around the world. Martin, do you agree with the research?
I mean, it's one of those things, and it is hardly the most surprising findings in the world. You know, as somebody who, you know, dreamt of coming and living in Australia when I was in the UK, you know, you think of it and you think of, you know, lovely beaches, great weather, laid-back lifestyle. You don't think of cutting-edge technology. So I wasn't altogether surprised. You know, part of the appeal of the place is that, yeah, it is very much the lifestyle, and I'm not surprised people would not think of technology as front of mind when they think of Australia. I mean, sometimes I do feel like that bloke out of Life on Mars who's woken up in the 1970s, but you know, that's part of the fun.
Next, Merrick moves to Triple M.
Merrick Watts, who spent 10 years in the breakfast slot at Nova 96.9, has been announced as the new drive host at Triple M.
Breakfast is maybe a five-year cycle, which means I repeated it twice, which means I was there twice as long as I should have been. Not that it was a bad thing, but I think that after 5 years, definitely, Rosso and I started to notice physical and mental change. You just become more tired, you know. And I don't think it's really necessarily affected by age, but I think you do start to wear down, and you know, you try and get those leave periods. They give you quite a lot of holidays typically in breakfast so that you can recover. But it's never enough because you're always at war with your own body clock.
Do you think maybe you should have gone earlier? Is that what you're saying?
I think if Ross and I had left after 5 years and gone away for a year or two and come back, we may have gone through a second cycle that would have been more like the first cycle? I don't know. I mean, you can never tell. But, you know, it's hard to try and guesstimate what could have been, or, you know, you can't hypothesise.
So, Tim, you chatted to him, and there's a video on Mumbrella. Do you think he saw his departure from Nova coming?
Do you know, I think one of the things about certainly TV and radio is often with the people at the top of the game becoming really well-known is almost inevitably they're going to go out in some way as failures, because unless you're really smart and you go out when you're on top, then you fall away, and that's when it's time to move on. And you, if you're not careful, that's what you're remembered as. You know, thinking of John Laws, he was really wise in going out on top, and then he was foolish enough to come back, and it's not been the same. You know, Merrick, particularly when it was Merrick and Rosso, had a great 10 years. You know, Nova redefined the Sydney market, redefined the national market as well. Merrick was presenting the Sydney breakfast show. I think it kind of, by the time that Rosso went, it felt like maybe they, you know, changes were being rung. Obviously, there were a number of different presenter combinations from that point onwards, and it just never seemed to quite get there. You know, sort of Cher was kind of okay. I think it was about sort of 6, 7. He's going to come into drive for Triple M with, certainly in Sydney, with the share of just below 5, which actually means that, you know, he can probably have an impact quite quickly, and I'm sure there's an audience. And in terms of life stages, it makes a lot. You know, I'm guessing he's, what do you reckon, about 38, not quite 40, I suspect. You know, I'm guessing something like that. You know, so in life stages, Triple M is probably where he should be, rather than, you know, chasing, you know, a 19-year-old radio audience on Nova.
Yeah. Yeah, a couple of things that emerged from the video. One of the quotes was, you did ask him about working with Rosso again. Obviously, he's been asked that question a number of times. What do you think? Do you think he will?
No time soon. I mean, like, you know, as he made the point, you know, contractually they're on different networks now. They've never really talked about, you know, what quite led to the end of the partnership. You know, they never say negative things about each other in public. So who knows whether there's a real reason why they wouldn't, but certainly it feels like at the moment that, you know, the stars aren't going to quite align. We nearly, with Mumbrella 360, we nearly had them reunited on stage at the same time when Rosso was moderating and Merrick presented in the Battle of the Media debate, but that was when Rosso had to dash off for, he'd just become a proud parent that week, so he wasn't there for that final session. So I think, Martin, you had to step in on that session instead.
Yeah, it was time to get a professional on the job.
Also, he said in the video that he's a competitive chap. What sort of share in his mind do you think he'll be going for in his new slot?
I mean, it's tough. I mean, if you look at the, and this is, although it's national, I suspect that his first marker will be the Sydney numbers. As I say, 4.7 in Sydney at the moment. You know, looking right the way up, I think if memory serves, 2GB's got the biggest share at Drive, which is about 11%, which is Ben Fordham. Slightly different, obviously, when it's talk versus music, you know. And that's the thing. It's quite closely bunched. You know, if he can get up to sevens or something, then, you know, that's kind of in play. You know, we in Drive, since we saw Hamish and Andy step down Monday to Thursday, their replacements, Fifi and Jules, have actually hung on to their ratings pretty much. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you wonder whether, you know, this could be a disruption in the market. Although Sister Station, obviously, because they're the Today Network, which is another Southern Cross or Stereo brand. So, you know, I think possibly he's in with a shout of moving things a bit.
Mm. Any thoughts on how his style will change? Obviously, one of the quotes he was saying on video is that he was constantly at war with his own body clock. Obviously, he's got a bit more time to prepare, he was saying, for each session. Do you think we'll see a different Merrick in this slot?
I mean, different style anyway, because, you know, what you're looking at in breakfast is a lot of your preparation has to be done the day before, versus Drive Time. It can be fresher because you're building up to your show. You're hopefully more topical, more current, because you're talking about stuff that, you know, you've prepared that day. But, you know, they're I don't think he was just being cagey. I think genuinely they haven't worked out the plan in terms of who might co-present, exactly what the format will be, except, you know, very obviously, you know, they're promoting the three planks, which kind of sums up Triple M of comedy, of sport and of rock music, you know. So I don't know if I'm just falling for the hype, but it does feel to me like Triple M is on the way back up at the moment.
Next, Charlie's Angels have their wings clipped already.
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone All-Time Prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
Once upon a time, there were three little girls who went to the police academy.
We saw the debut of a few new shows this week. On Tuesday, on 9, was The Return, the highly promoted remake of Charlie's Angels at 7:30, which actually didn't do great, did about 815,000 metro. It was followed by the second outing for Ashton Kutcher in 2.5 Men, which pulled in 1.252 million, which is not much more than half of its debut the previous week, so not going in the right direction there. Then we had the telly-loving Joy of Sets follow on 9, which, sad to say, halved its audience to about 545,000 after a good opening the previous week. Meanwhile, the return of NCIS brought 10 an audience of just over 1 million, which has been rare for the network of late. Junior MasterChef has been the only other programme for 10 recently, which has had a 5-city metro audience of over 1 million in the last 6 weeks or so. When it returned on Sunday night, though, it only just got about half of what it did for its first episode last year. It pulled in about 1.129 this time round, and then the following night slipped back below 1 million. And one other new twist to mention this week is the Gruen transfer becoming Gruen Planet, and still staying just the right side of 1 million. Colin, any surprises for you there?
No, I don't think so. I was disappointed to see the Joy of Sets drop by quite a large percent.
One for the TV fans, that one, really, isn't it?
I think so, yes. One, it's kind of meta-broadcasting or something, isn't it? As for Junior MasterChef, it's stayed above 1 million, but I don't think it's going to stay that strong. I'm not too familiar with the junior version. I wasn't in the country last year. It seems a little saccharine to me. But Robin, thoughts?
A thought just struck me on all these TV shows, really. I mean, I've been in the country since March. We've done story after story after story on ratings declines. I mean, ratings halving, I mean, ratings tumbles for so many big format shows. And are we actually seeing, I'd like to do some sort of analysis on ratings overall for Television Australia. Is just everything falling? I mean, yeah, obviously there have been successes, MasterChef, The Block, etc. But so many shows have just seen dwindling audiences.
In defence, though, I think sometimes we are a bit unfair in making too much of how a show does in its first episode to the second, because what will tend to happen is, particularly something like 2.5 Men, there'll be a real curiosity factor and also heavy promotion, advertising promotion, you know, full-page ads in the newspaper. So it's not surprising that people then tune in. And equally, you know, when that promotion falls away, not totally surprising that that the audience sort of fall away. There are very few shows, I think, which actually sustain the audience through from the launch, unless they launch slowly and grow bigger. You know, MasterChef was the obvious example of that. And one more point was just that, you know, the way the scenario has changed in the last couple of years is the rise of the digital channels. There's more choice for viewers. Mm.
But the decline seemed to be, I was looking at the numbers this week, the decline seems to be across the board, which would suggest that the marketing's good but the product's poor.
Yeah, well, I'd like to know whether the overall number is down. It wouldn't surprise me if when you add in the digital channels, that's where the viewers are. They're just, you know, they're choosing between 12 or 15 channels for free-to-air homes rather than just 4 or 5 channels. You know, so there's just more likelihood to flip around.
But what about the kind of water cooler conversation in the office where, did you see so-and-so last night? No, I didn't. Oh, it was great. And then the audience grows. I mean, you know, we're talking about audiences halving from the first episode to the second.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, you shouldn't have to market while a show's on. A show should be self-sustaining. I mean, I've talked to producers saying that TV is about momentum. Ratings are about momentum.
Yeah, maybe it's about finding a natural level, though. You know, so, and your natural level is not your first episode. You know, you can make the argument if something comes in at 2 and then settles at 1.2, that is self-sustaining, even though it's a big fall.
Yeah, so it's a sort of natural drop, and so a show will find its natural level and that's it. So in marketing terms, what do you think? Do you think broadcasters are going wrong in terms of when and where they're spending their marketing dollars to sustain a show?
Chris Stevenson made a good point from PhD, made a good point in the podcast a couple of weeks back when he was talking about the fact that we still tend to see the networks promote individual shows rather than themselves and the values around the networks. And I think certainly there's an argument to be said that the networks should be doing more to stand for something beyond individual shows.
Their brands are too weak and they need to actually market the brands themselves, right?
Exactly.
Merrick Watts on the interview was talking about, we were talking about the Triple M listener, and he was talking about how you can't, you know, put viewers or listeners in one particular box and say they're a Channel 7 viewer. What would be the point of a channel saying, hey, look, we're Channel 7, when it comes down to that they swap anyway?
The argument, again, going falling back to Chris's argument, is that if you can even influence a 1% shift in share of audience by doing that, so subconsciously just have someone think, OK, Channel 7 or Channel 9 or Channel 10, they're my favourite network, or I regard them slightly better. So I'm going to trust them with this new show because it's on this network, it's probably good. If even a small number of people do that, they increase share by half or 1%, that's millions upon millions of dollars.
Tim, what do you think of a show that you mentioned earlier on in the intro, Gruen Planet, formerly Gruen Transfer?
Yeah, so just for the last few episodes of the run, much like they did in the election, only this time it's Gruen Planet. Looking at the world of spin, I'm a very, very big fan of Gruen Transfer. I think it's great. For me, Gruen Planet didn't completely work. It kind of felt like mostly it was Gruen Transfer with a little bit of a nod towards politics. I'd like to see it with a couple of other, you know, for a couple more weeks with different guests. I'm not sure it was the strongest guest lineup. Mm. I wasn't terrible. I was, you know, very topical. So, for instance, they were looking at the malting campaign to supposedly kill off Louis the Fly, which is something we've written about as being fairly cynical about the way they've been treating the public over that one. They took a similar view to that, and with a couple of other things, they were quite topical with what they did. So, you know, good, you know, overall pretty good, promising, but I can just remember those first couple of episodes of this new series of Gruen Transfer thinking, these guys have done it again. This is just great. You absolutely have to watch this. You know, this is the definitive conversation on whatever the aspect of advertising they were looking at. And I didn't quite get that feeling almost of jealousy last night.
Yes, I mean, the strategy has been topicality, yeah, as you mentioned.
Much later record.
Yeah, it's filmed 24 hours before broadcast to give that topical edge. I'm not sure really a show like this needs it, does it? Is newness, newsiness, the currency of this sort of show that it needs?
I mean, it probably had something to it. Like, as I say, Mortine was a good example that they were able to get in because it was late. I'm not sure whether that's what's making or breaking it.
There was one very interesting moment when they were discussing how Julia Gillard could improve her PR, and the suggestion was made that she should bugger the polls and legalise gay marriage, and my thought was that should probably be the other way round, shouldn't it?
That is all we have time for today. Thank you to Martin.
Thank you.
To Robin.
Cheers, Tim.
To Alice.
Thanks.
And to Colin.
Thank you.
The Mumbrella Cast was sponsored by CRadioDifferently.com and recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle-pip.